This is Let's Keep It Real with Sandy Joy Weston, your weekly dose of positivity with awesome stories and guests from all over the world. It's an opportunity to learn some great new things and expand your mind. We'll tackle topics from all areas of life, and as always with Sandy, the sky's the limit.
Hello, hello, my Let's Keep It Real people. You are in for a treat today because it's the rare, exciting occasion that I got to experience my guest in person. Dr. Aaron McConnell is in the house. How are you, Aaron?
I'm doing great, Sandy. I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I had the privilege of experiencing Aaron in motion. I mean, in whoo! How many times did I come? Two or three? I think two.
I think it was twice, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll talk. We'll get into that. But I know some of you know about once a month, I'm going out and about town to give you the down and dirty of people that I really think you need to not only listen to, but if you're anywhere in the vicinity, you got to see him and experience him. But before we get into that, let me tell you about Dr. Aaron McConnell. He is a dynamic therapist with a passion for enhancing his clients' quality of life, as well as an exceptional drive for higher education, for sure. His personal ideology of physical therapy is that each client should be treated with a customized approach based on an assessment, very good assessment, of the body and nervous system, as well as the client's personal goals. His views, this has a collaborative, let me make sure I say that again. He views this as a collaborative process, don't cut that, with his clients and applies manual techniques, therapeutic exercise, and neuromuscular re-education to generate positive change for each person. That was a mouthful. Aaron, you get to pick one word that best describes your past 30 days, whatever pops into your head, and why you picked it.
I would probably say dense.
I can tell you, we've never had that word. Dense. All right. So why dense?
Well, I think for the last 30 days, I've probably done a deeper dive into some of my educational work that is very dense material. And then my brain doesn't like letting go of things. And so it wants to know the answer. So if a question pops into my head during something, then I will sort of write it down and then go digging into the depths of the internet to sort of try to figure out if I can find an answer to the question. And that usually lends me to reading and printing out more research papers than I could possibly handle, so I could kind of dig into that. I also think that we lost one of our dogs recently, so that's always like a heavy thing within that. So he was with us for 9 years, and he's a great Doberman. But that's always tough.
All right, that I understand, dense. And so, you know, I was fortunate enough that Aaron, one of his sites is only 20 minutes from where I live, which was like, you got to be kidding. So I went there. I think my first session could have lasted almost 2 hours, would you say?
Yep, yeah, close to it.
And, you know, I've owned health clubs. I even had physical therapy, chiropractors, massage therapists in my club. Met a lot of great people, but I've never experienced something like Aaron. It was so fascinating. And what I love is because, well, he took a little more time explaining it to me, but that you could take this, what you do, you seek knowledge, all this complicated stuff, and break it down to be user-friendly so that I can understand what you were doing. And then more importantly, apply it to my wacky body. So those of you who know me, well, a lot of you don't know me, but I was born with like hip dysplasia. My hips are tilted way far forward, so they're uneven, and my feet are flat. And then I had bunions and hammer toes from dancing. And I'm sure I go in and Aaron just made me feel so comfortable. So this is what I want to start with, Aaron.
Yep.
Because they're going to be so fascinated with this. Like, were you thinking, oh my God, they don't know where to begin with her? Or let's just explore and figure it out.
I think I'm more of just an explorer or figure it out, just because I know that the way that I approach things tends to take a whole lot of things all into account. And it's kind of like, can you address all of them? Well, sure. Yeah. If you've got like, you know, a few years, yeah, we can address everything. But in the moment, you really have to look at it from a perspective of, all right, who's the biggest problem in this chain of events that has occurred that is our body, our movement, our nervous system, all that sort of stuff. And so being able to look at it and say, okay, hey, what are you the worst at? Because what you're the worst at on testing or examination or anything else like that, that's probably one of the most important things to look at. But with the consideration for that, certain aspects of the nervous system carry a heavier weight than other things. So like your little toe, yes, it's important. Anyone who has broken their little toe knows that, yeah, it's really important because it hurts a mess if you break it. At the same time, if I compare my little toe with my left eye carries a way heavier load on how the whole system functions than my left little toe. Even my left little toe is totally smashed. Just on how there's a hierarchy in the nervous system, you kind of have to pick and choose where you start.
Well, you know what? Of all the things we did, and we did a lot of different things, what I found fascinating and what really impressed me is that even though I was walking all kinds of uneven and my foot is like, you know, if I want to put my feet together, one is like a few inches off the ground, you listen to me. You're like, are you in pain? I go, no. Yeah, like you listened to what I had to say, and I had adapted to that walk. And then you said, what was you could see my biggest concern was my neck and how it felt and the tightness of it. But you heard me. That doesn't usually happen. They see that I'm walking like this and they're like, oh God, we're going to go there first. And I'm like, but I'm not in pain there.
Right. Yeah. And I totally get that. And I have a great analogy for that. I usually explain it to clients when many times clients will come in and I'll ask them like how they're doing. I'm like, oh, I'm fine. And usually I ask them to elaborate, or I tell them that was a useless response. That doesn't help me. So like I think about it as myself as a human mechanic. The difference between me and your auto mechanic though is that your auto mechanic can take your car out, listen to all the noises, feel the vibration, test it out, and say, okay, yeah, I think I know what's going on. Maybe one millennia from now, we'll be able to just, you know, plug into each other's brains, be like, oh yeah, I can feel that. I know what's going on. For now, I have to rely on my client to tell me everything that's going on. And most of the time, by the time I at least get done the subjective, I at least have a good idea where I need to go. And I'm fine being wrong if I don't find that, but that's sort of why I have to go through all those different tests to basically figure out, am I wrong or am I right? Or is there something here that I just wasn't thinking about at all? But unless I test it, I don't know.
Okay. Can we talk about all the, here, wait, I got it. Cause I wanted to make sure I got it. Why? So I went in there and one of the things, I remember a lot of the stuff, but one of the things that stuck out, you made me follow this pen and the fact that I wasn't tracking left and right, but right to left. And then you had me say, okay, go home and do these exercises. And I did them.
Yep.
And I thought, okay, I'm open. How's this going to help my neck, whatever, but it did. So just, if you could just tell them a little bit about following the pen, go up the eyes and left and right and left. Okay, I'm done.
Okay, all right, that's fine. So primates, and humans are primates, regardless of whether you believe in evolution or not, we sort of fall in the same category. And we are dominated by our vision. So about 45% of your ability to move is governed from your ability to have good vision, symmetrical vision, and be able to move your eyes appropriately. To take that a step further, 70 to upwards of 90% of the information going into your brain is vision.
Okay.
So it might matter on whether or not you have good vision or bad vision, or if your eyes can move. So if your nervous system is, I can back up for a moment. So the nervous system, all it really cares about is keeping you safe in the moment, and it'll break anything it has to follow that rule. So in the circumstance where, say the eyes aren't tracking well to one side or one particular direction. Yeah, you could do a deep dive into neurology of what it means if your eyes can't track left, but that's not the goal. It's necessarily just thinking about, all right, if my eyes can't go left, or my brain doesn't feel safe to take my eyes left or right or whatever, what ends up happening is that your brain then tries to solve that problem somewhere else or tries to stop you from doing it. Well, if my eyes can't go right, and how my brain might avoid that is to lock my head into a left rotation.
Got it.
So it says, I don't like going this way, so I'm going to lock you up into this pattern so you stop looking in that direction. The same can be true in reverse, where it's like, all right, my eyes need to learn how to go right so that my eyes and my neck can separate motion from one another rather than one dragging the other for a ride. So the hard part is teasing out which is which. And sometimes it actually doesn't matter, because if I have someone do an eye drill and then have them reassess their movement, reassess their pain afterwards, and they feel better, it's like, I don't actually need to explain that. I can just demonstrate. It's like, this helps. So let's lead into that.
Well, I know I was fascinated because you're like, I could track, right? But I was going left, I would just skip over it. Like, yeah, right. Okay. You know? And I realized I was doing that. And so when I start doing it, I get frustrated, but it really does help the mobility of my neck and less tightening. You know, it's not 100%, but it's a million times better.
Right. And that's kind of where the challenge comes into play. It's like, yeah, we can address the local issue, and that's not wrong. It's just sometimes for individuals, it is incomplete. So if I treat someone's, like I have treated a shoulder patient today and they couldn't raise their arm, but they also couldn't coordinate on the same side of the body, which can sometimes be a neurological issue. And if you get them to coordinate somewhere else, it changes the muscle tone that you have in that part of the body or another part of the body, and then allows for altered movement simply because you got the nervous system to say, okay, hey, I think I know where this is better. And that makes it safe. And how the brain's really doing that, your brain's all the time, by to keep you safe, it's basically trying to predict the future.
Yeah.
And the more accurate it is at predicting the future, the safer it feels. So if there is a loss in ability to move, or a loss of sensation, or you have altered vision or hearing even, that changes your world perception and reduces your ability to create accurate predictions. As a result, you might feel a little less safe. And again, working on something local like the neck or the shoulder, where the problem technically is manifesting, might be useful. But if you don't address the reasons why the nervous system doesn't feel safe, which might be something else completely disassociated from it, that can, you can treat it and might feel better in the moment, but it won't stick because the rest of the system is just going to spin it back to where it was, because it's not looking at the root cause. And that's what I like to look towards.
Yeah. So I had a bunch of questions for you, by the way, that I sent out to my peeps. And we're not going to get to them all, but there are many people that don't live near you, of course. Mm-hmm. And I want to hit those questions first about how they can help themselves. So I make up names. So Billy Bob wants to know, hey, Aaron, I went once years ago to a physical therapist when I lived in another state that was awesome and customized my program, and it was incredible. Now, my insurance company sends me to a big, we'll just not say the name, big organization, and I feel like it's just cookie cutter, but that's what I got.
Yeah.
So how can I help myself when I know, okay, I go in, they have me do this, this, and this, and that's all that's available to me. Please help. This guy broke his wrist recently.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that is... sadly, 80% of the industry, at least, is that sort of setup, because that's a lot of organizations do things basically by the numbers, not by, hey, what is most efficacious for treating the patient. And so a lot of those places, they pump out volume. So literally, even if the physical therapist is brilliant and really wants to do their job, they have 10 minutes per patient. That is almost impossible to create significant change and really spend meaningful time with a client. So when you're sort of stuck with circumstances like that because the insurance company won't allow that to happen, my recommendation first is to ask questions as much as you can, because if you can get the therapist to sit down and talk to you, most therapists know a lot and they want to be able to help you.
Yeah.
But a lot of times they're stuck in the grind of being able to have to work with 5 or sometimes upwards of 6 patients an hour, which to me is nuts. Like I personally couldn't work in an environment like that, because I did for about a year, and it's probably the only time in my life that I was depressed was working in that kind of environment. And so I would ask a lot of questions within that. The other part I think you really need to be able to do is to be your own advocate. So the moment like some exercise feels easy, bring that up. Because if like physical therapists in general, especially in the outpatient world, love to make stuff harder. So if you tell me it's easy, okay, great, we're moving on. There's no need for me to be here. Yeah. And being able to spend the time to work on the things that are meaningful. And as soon as something becomes easy, then move on. I mean, for me, one of the approaches I use is that I, as you know, Sandy, from working with me, it's like, yeah, we did a little bit of treatment inside. There's a whole bunch of experiments. Then I send you home with a bunch of stuff. All right. And then that's your responsibility to take care of. There's no sense in me counting reps if I can spend a whole lot more time working with you doing something else or doing something that it can only be done in the clinic. And so when you're working with a therapist and you're working with confined amount of time that you get with the therapist, I would make sure that that time gets very wisely spent, both asking questions, trying to get specific as far as, hey, how do you fix this specific issue? Because sometimes it's easier to just say, hey, I can't move my wrist in this direction. All right, how can you do something to change this? Or what can I do at home to be able to fix this? And sadly, in environments like that, you sort of have to be your own advocate and push for more. Because otherwise, if you don't, then they're just going to sort of let you lather, rinse, repeat to do the same thing over and over again, and maybe occasionally revisit it to make it a few pounds harder, which really doesn't address both the what it needs to happen for the patient, but it also doesn't address the like real life circumstances. Because it might be like, yeah, okay, great, I can do a bunch of wrist strengthening exercises, but I still can't put my hand flat on the floor. All right, that flat on the floor to me is way more important than how strong your wrist is, unless the problem in and of itself is purely driven from strength, which it rarely is.
I like that. And I think you're right. I mean, you have to be an advocate for yourself and at least go, well, what about this? What about this? And tell them and try to push as much as you can, because even if they can't spend a lot of time with you, I do know physical therapists will be like, hey, look this up, or hey, do this at home.
Yep.
And they'll try to help you in that way. All right. So this one's from a physical therapist.
That's great.
Cracking up. We'll call her Sally. Dear Aaron, I am able to spend time with my clients. I have my own practice. I love what I do, but I'm ready to bang my head against the wall. How do you get your clients to do their home exercises? I constantly feel like, well, I don't want to say what she said, but basically they're fibbing to her. They're not really doing them. And quote unquote, she hears over and over, well, they didn't seem like it really mattered. They're so like, you know, minimal.
Right. So two things come to mind. So one is I generally have a very honest conversation with most of my clients, if that is the case. And so I work in two different environments. I work in one environment that it takes insurance. I work in another environment that's my personal business that is cash based. So in both of those environments, I have a very frank conversation with them. It's like that if they're unable to participate in this, then they shouldn't be here.
Mm. Ooh. Okay.
And like I've had that conversation numerous times. I've only had two patients in a decade and a half I had to flat out discharge because they were non-compliant. They just flat out refused. I asked them why, and they're like, I just don't want to do it. And I'm like, we don't need to be here then. And most people don't want to hear that because they want to continue the treatment, because usually like when people come to visit physical therapy, it's like, regardless of the problem, most of the time they do feel better and they like come into the office and they like feeling better. But if they can't do this work at home, then we have to have a conversation. It's like, so my prescription might be exercise. And just like a physician's prescription is whatever pharmacy or imaging or whatever else they want to do. And just like, if you refuse to take a drug, well, the doctor's sort of puts their hands up and says, well, I can't help you. I'm sort of in the same circumstance as is every other physical therapist. So one is the honest conversation with them. The second piece of that is something I actually learned very early on in school. And I think my professor called it the wow concept, I call it more proof of concept, where it is you have to be able to demonstrate to them what their exercises are doing. Okay. So if I have someone do a drill, I'm going to test them and retest them immediately afterwards to demonstrate. It's like, look, I can change your ability to touch your toes by having you do this drill. Watch it happen. So it gets them to buy in to the process, because then they can see it for themselves. It's like, hey, this makes a difference.
And if you did that with me.
I did. I do that with everyone, because if I can't create some measurable change for them, whether that's with a hands-on technique or preferably with some type of exercise or movement that they can do on their own or changing how they're moving, I haven't figured out how to help them. But if I can give them something that I can demonstrate right then and there in a short period of time for them to do, and it should be minimal effort, it should be a reduced amount of time, it should require limited equipment or none. And if I can show them and say, hey, you do this thing and this gets better, it kind of gives them somewhat of a motivation or a reason and demonstration. It's like, oh, hey, I can actually take charge of this. It's empowering for the patient to be able to see that, oh, hey, this makes sense. And yes, there are certain times when it's like, yeah, okay, you just need to do the reps to be able to make the difference. And that's kind of the boring stuff. And the reason why patients don't do it is that so many times, like, hey, here are these 8 exercises. They're going to take you 3 to 4 minutes a piece. So you're going to need to reserve a half hour of your day to be able to do them. Oh, well, wait, you have 2 jobs and 3 kids and 4 dogs. Where are you going? No one's going to find that time. But if I can give you a drill you can do in 1 minute, and you can do that 5 times a day, you can probably find that time during the day. But it's just a matter of trying to figure out, hey, what's the minimal effective dose of the thing that I can give you that changes how you move or changes your symptoms in the moment on the fly?
That's so true. That's so true. It's just like working out. If the person was a couch potato and you say they want to work out an hour every day, it's not going to happen. It's going to last right. You know, you
week, stop. 2 weeks. That's why all the gyms make their money on January.
I get it. Okay. So I want to go over this one because I was cracking up because I was even thinking of this when I was practicing my speaking engagements. You keep what you practice, good or bad, makes no difference. And you know how they say practice makes perfect? There are no. Perfect, like it doesn't. You can keep practicing this wrong way. Yep. And that's the outcome. So dive into that more.
So I mean, I've heard the practice makes perfect. I think the better terminology for that is practice makes permanent. So when it comes to system with movement in particular, because the overwhelming majority of our brain is simply geared for movement. We like to think we're higher beings, and we sort of are because our frontal cortex is different. But in general, the overwhelming majority of our brain is just based on movement. And the challenge comes into play is that the brain is inherently lazy on a fundamental level. It wants to do the least amount of possible work. It will always take the easy path unless forced to take the hard one. The challenge.
Whoa, back up. That explains my family, but back up. I love you guys. Why?
So, and it's because the nervous system on a fundamental level is geared purely for survival of the moment.
Okay, I got
tomorrow.
You.
Tomorrow doesn't exist. The next 3 minutes that don't exist, it's going to be able to survive. And unlike plants stay alive primarily via chemical warfare. We stay alive because we move. So on a basic level, when you go to move, your brain assumes it's for the purpose of survival.
Okay, I see that.
That's why we limp. Like, it is not a good way to walk when you have injured something to limp. It doesn't promote a healthy movement pattern. It doesn't make anything feel better aside from your brain avoiding pain. But if you practice it enough, it becomes permanent. And you can't actually erase those patterns. Like, once you know how to do something poorly, you always know how to do it poorly. Doesn't mean you can't learn something else to know how it's better, but it's like you have this infinitely building library of movement in your brain. And the books you read the most often are the ones that you can most readily access. And because that is the one you most easily access, your brain will pick that one because it's easier.
Okay, keep going. I'm processing this.
When we're looking at movement, the challenge comes into play is that how you move on a regular basis determines a lot of stuff for your brain, but it also sort of gives you, like, these are the things that your brain's going to go through most easily, whether it hurts you or not. So movement, as you repeat poor movement patterns over and over again, they become your baseline. And you could argue this.
It doesn't matter if you're in pain or not. It doesn't matter.
Correct. Yes. And all of it. And again, not all of these are harmful. Because again, you could repeat a really good movement pattern over, and that's your baseline movement pattern. Like, breathing is kind of one of the easiest ones that I target for most of my clients because, all right, you could take anywhere between 20 to 25,000 breaths in a day. Rough estimate, 100,000 reps, you create a new pattern. So you break a rib and you breathe differently for 2 weeks. Well, you got at least 250,000 reps you just did right there. That's a different breathing pattern. And now you have a new baseline.
Oh, okay. This is making so much sense. Okay. I get it.
Yeah.
So I just want to do that for people because this is a lot to take in for some.
Yep.
Brain's lazy. I got that. Path of least resistance. Got that. When you get injured, even if you're in pain, that's your new baseline.
It can be. Yes.
It can be.
Like, pain is a neurological signature in the brain. So just like you can practice movement, that is a neurological pattern. You can practice pain just as readily.
Okay. And so is it difficult? Let's say, I'll give you an example. Someone I know got injured and their whole walking style is off. Okay. And they're in pain slightly every day. But after years of doing it, is it way more difficult to change, or does it matter how you can still change no matter what?
You can still change no matter what. The more time you have spent laying down neurological patterns over and over and over again, the stronger they get and the harder they are to break free from. But it doesn't mean you can't. It just means that you need to know or figure out how to be able to do that. And sometimes it seems like there are very strange things that can come along with that. And I get into a bunch of those when I do assessments. But the idea essentially is that the more you practice something, so taking it, I usually use your signature as a case in point. When was the last time you thought about it?
No way. Haven't.
Right. So hundreds of thousands of times you've signed your name. And then if I said, okay, hey, we're going to change your whole name and make you sign it differently. You're going to have to create a whole new pattern, but your brain's been so used to signing your name. If you didn't think about it in the moment, you just sit down and just crank out your name without any thought and suddenly realize, wait, I was supposed to change that to a different name. So that pattern is going to be hard to break because it's such a long-standing, consistent one, but it is changeable. It just usually requires a little more forethought. And then when it comes to injuries, it's also a matter of looking at it from a setup of being able to see who else came along for that ride. So yeah, you might've sprained your ankle, but that then changed how your hip and all of your spine musculature functioned when you stand on that foot. And now you've got a stiff rib cage that won't let you move, which then cascades itself and reinforces the ankle problem.
Okay. So this leads me into another question I got over and over again, and you touched on it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you've developed patterns that don't serve you well, and you've been doing it for years, you can still change those patterns. You don't give up hope. And the biggest question was, even when I'm 75?
Even when you're 75. My oldest patient that I've worked with was 94, and we can still create change. Now, obviously, there's like structural changes that happen as we age, and yeah, I can't subvert those. But from a nervous system perspective, the brain is always capable of change. Now, there are times in our life that we are more capable of change, and that's particularly inside of being in childhood, in adolescence, and pretty much under the age of 25. So the nervous system is more malleable at those points, but doesn't mean it can't change later. Just, yeah, depends on what's happened for the nervous system, what's happened for the body, why those patterns have become ingrained. And it can obviously get very complicated when you start taking into all the possibilities on how the nervous system processes movement and how it creates pain. Because I definitely wanted to make sure I touched on this, is that you don't have any pain receptors. There's no such thing. You have nociceptors in the body, and nociceptors are danger receptors or threat receptors. And they send a message up to your brain, and your brain makes a decision as to whether or not you're going to experience pain.
Damn brain.
Right. And it's, again, the pain is just a behavior change tool of the nervous system to try to get you to do something different. And humans, I think, are the dumbest creatures on the planet when it comes to pain. We push through constantly, all the time. And because we think it's okay. Because we've like rationalized to ourselves that it's okay. And the rest of our nervous system is sitting there screaming at us to be able to do something different. Yeah. And that something different could just as readily be like, hey, just shift to your left a little. And that might be all it takes.
Yeah.
And that's always the challenge with pain, is that like we always assume that pain means you're injured. And the reality is that it really doesn't have to be at all. There's no direct correlation between the experience of pain and injury or damage or inflammation. Now, sometimes, yeah, if I step on a thumbtack, it's going to be really accurate. Okay? But like an easy case, I'll give you a story from one of my clients. And this is very much earlier in my career when I didn't know nearly as much about neurology as I do now. And gentlemen,
okay,
came to me.
Hold on one second because I got to break it down, because I want to make, this is so huge and I've never heard this before. I want to make sure I'm following you. That, and do you like that my dog came in, Dawson?
I love dogs.
All right. Dawson, would you like to get out again? Okay. So, because I think I want to make sure before you move on to the next story, this is such a big point. I thought you said pain doesn't mean you're in pain.
No, pain doesn't mean you're injured.
Injured. Okay.
Yeah. You are in pain. Yeah. No, the pain is very real, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from the source you think it does. Technically, the source of all pain is your brain.
Okay. Stop there.
Yep.
Or is the story going to explain it? Because I still am confused. So
the story will explain it a little bit, because okay. And it's a quick story. It's really easy. So I had a gentleman referred to me for just nebulous knee pain. Like all the special tests showed nothing. Mechanical exams showed nothing. You couldn't provoke it. And he could be sitting still. His knee suddenly hurts. He could do stairs one day and be fine. Stairs another day, it hurts. And I normally talk with my hands. And as I'm explaining things, I'm doing big motions. And he follows my hand over to his right side. His eyes follow it, and his left eye just spins out to his left and just takes a vacation. His right eye is looking at my hand. His left eye is way over off in somewhere else on the left. And for me, it's like I see stuff like that, and I can't let it go. And so I'm like, all right, let's look at a few things. And so I start having him just track my finger to his right repeatedly. I get about 7 reps in of his eyes trying to go to the right, and every single time his left eye spins out, he's like, my left knee is hurting. I'm like, all right, let's go the other way. We take his eyes, and we follow his eyes the other way. And about 4 or 5 reps in, I'm like, how's your knee? It's like, it doesn't hurt. Okay. There's nothing wrong with his knee. Now, why his brain elected his knee to be the place of behavior change, I have no idea. If I knew that, I'd be making way more money.
Yeah.
So where that comes into play, pain is just an indicator that your nervous system thinks it's not safe. And okay, that can... That.
Your nerve... Yep. Pain is an indicator from your brain that your nervous system is not safe.
Yeah, that something about you is not safe. Now, sometimes, again, it's very accurate and it's appropriate. Okay. But other times,
my finger hurts.
Right. But if you've ever been a gardener or worked out in the woods or chopped wood and you look down and suddenly look at your hand or your arm, you're like, why am I bleeding? Okay. You were literally just harmed, but your brain didn't register anything because
it deprioritized.
Right. Then deprioritize that. Same thing happens with soldiers and police officers that are wounded in a firefight. More often than not, they don't feel the bullet. They feel like they get punched because they can't ignore the physical motion that the bullet will apply to the body, but their brain can ignore the pain 100%. And it can actually do that for hours. And so the place where your nervous system gets threatened is going back to that idea of, can it predict accurately? And when systems are in conflict with one another or not giving good information or not organizing appropriately, the brain can't predict as well. If you can't predict the future, you can't make the future safe. Therefore, you're under more likely to experience threat. Now, you may experience that as pain, or you may experience it as tightness or weakness, dizziness, anxiety, loss of vision, changes in hearing. All of those things can be manifestations of how the nervous system is basically threatened and trying to figure out a way to stop you.
Aaron, this is very complicated.
Yes, it is. I wish it was more simplistic and...
But exciting. Like, it explains so many things. So I have a question for you, because this was really whacked. So you know how my body is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Weird. Da, 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 da. And you gave me some little feet. Different feet exercises, rolling in, sure. whatever. I go see my friend who hasn't seen me in a while. I was in Raleigh, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, quote unquote, you're walking normal, meaning... I'm walking without, being off. What are you doing? I got rolling my tootsies. Until I check. She's like, well, what she couldn't understand is, and by the way, it's not perfect because sometimes when I walk, if I have a long gait, it'll throw me off.
Mm-hmm.
But, I
sure.
know what but how is that possible when structurally I know from MRIs and x-rays,
yep.
my hips structurally, they're like, maybe over 20 years ago, you should get a hip replacement. And then another guy who's an orthopod who I love said, just keep doing you, do the visual, do the mental, you're going to be fine, you'll let me know. How is that? She's like, I don't understand.
Right.
How are you walking? Are you in any pain? I'm like, no, I don't know why. I don't know. How's that possible? I get that you gave me exercise to do.
Yep.
And I do them. And I'm barefoot a lot. And I do my little things. I'm very good. I'll meditate and do them. I'll do one.
Yeah.
But structurally, I'm still the same person.
Yep.
Okay.
So I can actually help to simplify this. So your brain works in sort of a 3-step process. You have sensory information comes in. Now, whether that's from your vision, your inner ear, the temperature on your skin, the tension on your skin, the movement of your joints, that all gives you information that comes into the brain. And then what your brain should do is it should process it, integrate it, if it's appropriate, And then you have an output. And the simplistic output in this case would be movement, or you're walking. Okay. So by doing the drills, we kind of work through that, because the movement in and of itself also creates sensory feedback. So that's kind of how we know. It's like, hey, I put my foot down this way or that way. Well, you took a motor action, so your brain made a decision to do that. But then you also get feedback of like, oh, hey, that was right, that was not right, based off of what you wanted to do. So the goal of the exercises was first to create a change in sensory information. So by changing the sensory information, I light up certain areas of your brain that say, okay, hey, we know where this thing is better now that we've got sensory information coming in.
Okay.
Okay. That sensory information, when repeated and done with a focus on the quality of the motion, so you're trying to error detect, make sure you're not doing things that you're not supposed to be doing. But by doing that, you create more connectivity for your brain. That increase in connectivity smooths out the movement patterns, which makes it work easier, because we can't change structure, but we can get your brain to be more efficient at the structure you have.
I think it's a miracle.
I've been told that before, and I try to downplay that as much as possible, because to me it's just neuroscience, but sometimes it does seem like a miracle.
And I know what my body looks structurally. Yes. The one guy who got the body-mind connection, I love this guy, years ago said, just do you, meaning connect whatever. But I still didn't understand from this way. And I didn't even know I was walking more balanced. And she's like, what did you do? Get a new, I'm like, no, I did nothing.
We did something. You got
I
your brain.
I did something, but I mean, didn't get structural. Yep. Like, it's still the same.
Yep.
It's probably still bone on bone, but like, and I'm not kidding you. I'm not in pain.
Yep. That's great.
Phenomenal. All right. I knew this was going to happen. I could talk to you forever, and I'm probably not going to get into all the questions, but he's here. I'm sure he'll be happy to answer more of your questions. The thing I wanted to play around with is explore different and new ways to move and learn to play in that space. I feel like I was doing that.
Yeah.
You know, that I was like, ooh, if I try this, if I try that.
Yep.
For example, I realize that with my fun body, amazing, unique body, if I run, it's actually better for me than if I walk with a long gait.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And everybody's like, well, you shouldn't be running. And running feels great to me. And then I realized I played with it. It's because I'm not, like, some of my friends are speed walkers. When I'm trying to walk with them, my gait gets longer and my body doesn't like that. So for me, right, I'm better off running next to them.
Right. And that's kind of where you had to adapt based off of sort of the system you have set up and work within that confines. And we sort of do this in infancy. Like, all we do as infants is explore movement. That is our primary job. Okay. And as we explore movement, we slowly get more efficient at it. But we're not blank slates as infants, but we got very few resources, and gravity is really tough for us. And so once an infant knows how to do something, they generally will repeat it exactly the same way over and over again, because that's the only tool they have. And it's not until we start exploring that more and more, we start thinking, oh, I can do it this way, I can do it that way, I can change how I'm moving. And so, like, and I think what we don't do, especially inside of the movement and fitness industry, is play with our movement, because it's like, oh, I could do this many reps, there's this exact form. And again, they're not wrong. But I think that from a standpoint of improving the quality of your movement, the breadth of your movement, and your ability to control it, basically requires you to explore the unknown corners of how your body operates and moves. And that requires taking some time and being like, okay, hey, I'm going to just see how this moves and see what this feels like. And you, like you said, you were doing that where you were like trying different things and trying different movements. And that can also be done literally anywhere in the body. And that you could, and the more you kind of work through it and you can challenge it without creating a negative response, then that exploration allows your brain to sort of start mapping that area better. The better map you have, the more accurate your predictions are.
By the way, I forgot to tell you, I do have a standing desk over here. I don't use it for the podcast, but I got one of those things where, I don't know what you call it, an artist desk. Like, so you're writing like this. What do you call it?
Yeah, so like it's more like an architect's desk, but it's got the ability to lever up at it so you can write on an angle as opposed to a flat surface.
So I do a lot of writing and I'm left-handed, and you know, there's discomfort. And so I got that, and all of a sudden, like, oh my God, it's great. But then I realized, like, even right now, it's, I think my son took it. I'm not using it for the podcast, and I can feel my body doesn't like this. Flat writing, it likes the angle because I must be doing something like that. And I'm like, wait a minute, what's different today? Damn kid. So he's an artist. He took it. And I'm like, but I wasn't even thinking it was a big deal, but it really matters because I'm up like this, right? And I write a lot. I don't like to type.
Yeah. And the old school lift top desks that were on an angle that we used to have in school, that angle was purposeful. It was a minimum of 22 degrees.
Oh.
And the reason for that was because at a flat surface, the writing arm shoulder rolls forward, but the head has to turn to match. And now I'm in a head turned, shoulder forward rotated position the whole time that I'm writing. Whereas when you bring that angle up, it lets the shoulder just sit back into more of a neutral position. The head can be more centered and eyes are down to be able to write. So it puts you on a little bit of a better angle.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, and that's such a simple change though. But it's like you said, if I'm practicing over and over again, this behavior, you know, it's just going to keeping the same thing. And yet it's discomfort, but I'm still doing the same thing over and over again. But even for me, by the way, to make that change, all right, how am I going to set up my desk? It might take a beat, even though I'm in discomfort, which doesn't even make sense because it doesn't make sense.
Right. And that's sort of the challenge of being human is that we can sort of consciously override a bunch of things that the brain is trying to tell us. And I always tell people, it's like, dogs are smarter than we are. Dog hurts its foot. What does it do? Pick up the foot and try not to put it down unless it absolutely has to. Well, what we do is say, nah, this hurts. Let me walk on this for or run on this, or let me stay with this for, and I always ask clients how long they've experienced these symptoms. And I've had some people say it's like my whole life. And I'm like, yeah. And I've run into two cases where that was actually true because there was like infancy injuries and that had been extended into their whole life. More often people have just experienced so long, their brain doesn't even remember what it's like to not be in pain. So they just choose to live with it. The challenge is that
absolutely
in ignoring that messaging system from the brain's just going to keep getting louder. And then it's going to keep handicapping other things. Maybe not your pain. Maybe it's going to stiffen something up or it's going to restrict your movement. It's going to restrict your balance. It's going to make you dizzy until you basically have no choice but to stop.
So true. Been there, done that. Okay. All right. I want to get this one in because I think this is really, really important. What do you feel about a lot of the people that listen and watch me? They go on different types of YouTube channels. Mm-hmm. To get information on how to help themselves because they don't have it available to them.
Sure.
And I don't know if there's ones you like more than others, and I get it's generic and, you know, there's certain things, but they say sometimes it helps. Like, okay, it's a certain thing. If your neck is tight, do this and that. I don't know how you feel about that. So I want to hit that before we go.
I mean, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with it on just a conceptual level. I think the challenge is in when we take that information and we assume it's a prescription. And it's like, oh, I have back pain. I guess I should do press-ups.
Okay.
Maybe. Or maybe that's not going to work. So I think that sometimes is like dependent on more how someone responds to it. So like what I tell a lot of my clients is that the clinic is the laboratory. All I do all day is run experiments to figure out what works for someone, what doesn't, what maybe makes them worse. And all of that gives me information about where I need to go. If we're in a circumstance where we don't have access to a clinician or you're in a foreign country and you're like, hey, I have insurance in this foreign country, whatever, then we have to look at that and say, okay, hey, I'm going to watch this video. All right, they gave me this one thing. Let me try this one thing, retest. So it's a little tedious because you then have to go through a whole bunch of different things. So if someone shows you 18 things in a video, yeah, you might be there a while and you might not want to do it all at once. But it's a matter of figuring out, it's like, hey, if I do this thing, does it make a change? The nervous system responds lightning fast, okay? It's like for your neck, for a case in point, it's like, all right, 5 or 6 reps of eye motion and suddenly the neck says, yeah, I like that better.
Yeah, loved it.
And so because if the nervous system needs that input, it should respond relatively quickly. It's just a matter of figuring out, hey, is this the right information for me? And if we can like kind of test our movements, whether that is testing a movement that's restricted, testing a movement that's painful, or if something feels weak, then we can just go through those movements, kind of like assess for ourselves a baseline. And then, hey, let me try this one thing and then reassess your baseline. and see, did this do something positive for me? Did it make the pain better? Maybe it made the pain worse. And then if it made the pain worse, you know, okay, hey, maybe things that show up like that on my YouTube feed are not the direction I want to go. And sometimes then we have to go the other way, or we have to go a different direction and be able to, again, play with it. Is that you have, and that's just what requires you to be able to test it for yourself. And that's what I tell a lot of my clients, especially the ones that I don't see really frequently. I might see a client once a month or once every other month. And yeah. So in that meantime, I need to be able to make sure they know what they can test and the different things they can do. And sometimes it's like, hey, all today, all you're going to do is these two drills. You're going to do nothing else. And see what that changes for you as far as symptoms, movement, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, look at it. Just that angle of that desk top.
Mm-hmm.
Massive. Instantly helped. Yeah.
And sometimes I get lucky where I come up with single things. I had a client recently who came in with years and years of pain. And all we did was about two different eye movements. And it was all gone.
Isn't that crazy?
And as long as she keeps up with a couple times a day doing a few smooth pursuits of just tracking an object, she can eliminate 95% of her pain.
Oh my God, that she must be in heaven. Heaven. Yeah.
She was a little shocked, and she was telling me about it. She was telling a friend about it. It's like, he hasn't touched me, but I don't have any pain. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes it works that way. Other times, no, I need to put my hands on people to be able to do stuff. Yeah, I still do some traditional things, but the sort of taking that neurocentric approach. And that was for her, the biggest thing that popped out to me in her assessment was the fact it's like, your eyes are really not good at this. And we need you to get you better at this. So we can get you better at this. We can make a lot of stuff safer. And your brain's going to stop trying to give you pain to stop you from moving your eyes around, because the brain's not always the most efficient tool on where it chooses to give you pain. Because again, the brain is lazy. So it's far more likely to go to a pain it knows than create a new one. Mm-hmm. That's why, like, in there was a very large, well-done study done that was looking at lower back pain, and basically job satisfaction is the number one predictor of lower back pain.
I could see that. I could so see that.
Right. And so if, like, you're really unsatisfied with your job, there's that emotional stressor, there's a physical stress, depending on what you're doing. All that stuff dumps into the same bucket for the brain. And if your brain wants you to stop, it's like, hey, maybe you threw out your back once. And the last time you threw out your back, you took a week off work. Well, if I make your back hurt enough, you're not going to go to work again.
Oh, yes. Fascinating. Aaron, we got to go. I'm so sad. No, I'm not sad. I'm happy we got to spend this time together. And before we wrap up and tell them how they can find you, is there anything I didn't get in that you want to leave the Let's Keep It Real people with?
No, I think you got the big things. I mean, I think it's just important. I'll go to this, is that most people know more about their cars than their bodies. And I think that, could I change the oil in my own car? Yes. Am I efficient at it? No. But I know what I'm supposed to do in that context. So I can do some basic maintenance for myself. And I think everyone should be able to do that or learn that or something about that. But then sometimes if something goes wrong with the transmission, that is a very poor choice for me to bother with it, because I'll just have to tow the car in with a box full of parts and go, I did something wrong. And so then, in which case, sometimes that requires seeking out a professional near you, at the very least, to get an idea from the outside to say, okay, hey, do I need help with this, or can I maintain this mostly on my own? And a lot of people, if you just give them the tools, then they'll be able to pursue that readily on their own. And like I said, unfortunately, 80% of at least the physical therapy industry doesn't have the time to really spend with patients the way I honestly believe that almost all of them want to. There's still good resources, and there are other places out there. And sometimes, yeah, you have to sort of search for the person that you need. And sometimes that requires going through a number of different people, just like it would with any other profession. And so I think that if you can find someone like that near you and learn from them and make sure it's like, okay, hey, can I get homework? So are there things I can work on to maintain myself? And then immediately being able to check in with this and say, it's like, hey, how am I doing? Like, I think dentists have the greatest model. It's like, see me if there's a problem. If there's not, see me every 6 months for the rest of your life. I think if physical therapy could operate that way, we could save a lot of people a lot of time, money, and pain.
At first, I thought you said Dennis, and I was like, who's Dennis? But Dennis.
No, dentist.
Aaron, before we go, where can they find you if they wanted to work with you?
I mean, the probably the easiest thing is my website, and you'll have to forgive me. My website is extremely rudimentary. I am not a Luddite, but I am I don't have time for social media or any of that sort of stuff. So it's moveevolvethrive.com.
Okay. And if they wanted to work with you, they just go there.
Yeah, they can go there. There's a contact section. They can send me an email at any point and I'd be happy to work with them.
Okay. Say it one more time.
Moveevolvethrive.com.
Okay. Aaron, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. I really, really appreciate it. And I also appreciate you meeting with me in person.
Well, I was happy to be able to have the opportunity to work with you. And then I'm grateful that for the chance to be able to come on the podcast.
All right, my Let's Keep It Real people, come on. You're going to want to share, like, and rate this. There's so many people out there that could benefit from this episode. What's more important than your body, your health? It all works together. So until next time, you know what I'm going to say. Thanks, Aaron, and toodles.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to share and subscribe if you enjoyed the show. And remember, keep spreading the positive.